Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
A stroll in the woods, a day at the beach, a hike in the mountains. There's a reason so many of us plan our vacations far away from the noise and traffic of the city. We're taking care of our brains. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Perhaps without even realizing it, we crave time outdoors as a way of recharging our batteries. Now scientists are documenting the many fascinating ways that time spent in nature is different than hours passed indoors. And journalist Florence Williams joins us to talk about what they have discovered. Her article, This Is Your Brain on Nature, appears in the January issue of National Geographic magazine. Florence, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
What happens to us when we spend time outside in nature that does not happen so much when we're in the built environment?
When we're in the built environment, our brains are really stimulated to kind of a degree that we have trouble processing. You know, we're getting emails, we're getting text messages, we're trying to figure out where to park. We have all these inputs that we're trying to make sense of, and it's actually more exhausting on our brains than we sort of realize. And so what happens to us when we go into a park or a green space is that there's this instant drop in stimulation, and yet it's still an interesting, engaging environment. So we hit this kind of sweet spot, and it's a spot where our brain is happy and comfortable. It's where we evolved. And as a result of that, we become less stressed. We become calmer. Our heart rates actually lower. Our blood pressure drops. And scientists are just really beginning to figure this out.
Wow. You write about something called the 3-day effect. It's pretty astonishing what can happen if we're in the wilderness for 3 days.
It turns out that, as with many drugs, when we're exposed to nature, there's sort of a dose curve. So if we have a little bit of nature, like even a houseplant or a view out of our window, we may feel a small drop in stress. But when we're out for 2 or 3 days, there's this whole other realm of kind of physiological and cognitive and emotional changes that occur in our brain. And so I met with a researcher in Utah who's trying to quantify that. And he's actually, hooking people's brains up. I had my own brain hooked up to an EEG cap. And it was actually measuring blood flow into different regions of my brain as revealed through sort of brain waves. And it looked like what was going on with my brain, with a lot of other people's brains, is that their frontal cortex, which is the part of their brain that does a lot of task problem solving, sort of thinking about problems that we have to solve, that part of the brain actually gets less blood flow. And instead, the parts of our brain that are associated with empathy or with creativity get more blood flow.
To be clear, these effects are separate from the benefits of exercise, right, which so many of us associate with being outdoors.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of a confounding factor. I mean, a lot of scientists think, oh, sure, people feel better when they're in a park because they're exercising. They're getting more oxygen in their brain. And they kind of dismiss the nature effect as really just being an exercise effect. And so there are some researchers, around the world who are trying to tease that apart, and kind of separate out the exercise piece. And so, for example, they'll have someone walk on a treadmill or walk in a city. And then for the same amount of time, someone else will walk in a park or in a more arboretum or more tree-filled area. And they're actually seeing really quantitative and qualitative differences between what happens to those people's brains. So the people who walk in parks really tend to have these physiological changes with their blood pressure, with their stress hormones, like cortisol, are actually lowered more in these green spaces than in the urban spaces.
It would seem like this kind of research has tremendous implications for urban planners, right? Because you can have a cityscape that is really just all brick and glass and steel and concrete, or you can have one that incorporates at least a little bit of, plants and animals, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you're seeing this even in office building planning, within a building. For example, you go to the headquarters of Facebook or Google, and they're really they're sort of figuring this out. They're incorporated green roofs, green gardens, Mark Zuckerberg takes walking meetings, you know, when he needs to talk to someone, because he sort of values the benefit of not having all these distractions, which is pretty funny, I think, coming from the head of Facebook.
So if we're doing the same thing, approximately, like eating at the kitchen table versus eating a picnic under the tree, is there a difference there, too, in the effect on our brains?
Well, I don't know if that specific scenario has been a subject of science, but, you know, based on what we know, there could be. One thing that scientists are seeing is that when groups of people spend time together in nature outside, they feel closer. You know, they have sort of a more bonding experience. And so you're seeing this sometimes with wilderness therapy programs or even family therapy programs. There are programs for veterans with PTSD where groups of people are going out into the wilderness, and they're just seeing tremendous effects that are partly social, but that are really facilitated by being in this beautiful place.
That's really interesting because, you know, you can imagine like feeling good after some solitude out in nature. You know, you can rest your brain on a solo hike. Keeping track of other people and chatting the whole time would seem like it made for a very different experience.
Well, I think that's right. And nature seems to be able to really meet us where we are and kind of serve our particular needs. So, you know, I've heard someone describe it as sort of Prozac and Valium and, you know, caffeine, you know, and all these other drugs sort of wrapped up in one, because depending on what your needs are, you know, if you're someone like me, when I'm working on a story or writing an article, I really value the time alone in nature because I feel like I can problem solve. You know, I can work out some issues, you know, of my own. And, you know, if you read books like Cheryl Strayed's Wild, she walked the Pacific Crest Trail, you know, over a couple of months. And that really helped her. She was alone. That really helped her process grief and some other issues she was going through. So wilderness alone can be tremendous. But then if you're someone who's maybe struggling from depression, being with a group of people, you know, is actually really important.
Florence, how natural does nature need to be? For example, you know, my backyard is nice and green, but it's surrounded by a fence and it is right in the middle of the city.
That's a great question. And, you know, someone like me, I mean, I used to spend a lot of time in Colorado and I'm sort of a snob about it. You know, if it's not a snow-covered peak, I don't really consider it nature.
Right.
But what the science is showing, sort of surprising, is that really houseplants and the tree out your window really do seem to have, you know, a small but significant effect even on things like mood and on cognition. So you can take a micro break by even looking at a picture of nature on your computer. And even that, like a 40-second, you know, break can actually improve your mood and cognition to a small degree.
I was fascinated to learn that simulated nature can give us a bump, like a virtual reality sort of reproduction. And I don't think it's what anybody really wants, but it's better than nothing maybe in certain situations.
Yeah, I was surprised by that, too. And I was really skeptical about it because, you know, I tend to like the real thing, and putting on headphones and, you know, looking at a pretty picture just doesn't seem like it would do the same thing. But, you know, what some of these researchers are finding is that it really can help reduce our blood pressure faster than, you know, looking at a picture, for example, of an urban intersection. And so there are scientists who are very hopeful about being able to use virtual reality, for example, to improve the quality of life of people who, you know, may be disabled, may not be able to go outside, or, you know, may not have the resources to go on, you know, on a 3-day wilderness trip in Utah. So I guess it does have some potential, although I worry that if we rely too much on the virtual reality, that we'll be less drawn to the real thing.
Right. We'll be on our couches with special goggles on, experiencing the great outdoors.
Right. It's like the whole point of nature is to get us out of that.
Yeah. Are scientists who are researching this looking mostly at places that are leafy and green? Of course, nature is also, you know, the Sahara Desert and the tundra and places that maybe don't seem quite as welcoming.
Right, or parts of Texas. Yeah, I wondered about that too. And in fact, it looks like a lot of the research is being done in these very leafy, forested places. And I noticed a real bias, you know, in the researchers I talked to who tend to have a soft spot for forests. And I kept saying, well, what about the desert? You know, will it do the same thing? And they don't really know, although this researcher I spent time with in Utah, we were in the desert. We were in southern Utah, which is not heavily treed. You know, it's pretty barren, although it's rugged and beautiful. And there are, water features, which are known to be particularly sort of attractive features for people. So if you're not by a river or by a lake, if you can hear birdsong, that's actually supposed to be very influential as well.
I don't think this came up in the piece, but I've always been curious about why the sound of water is so relaxing to people. Did you come upon any kind of research into that area?
There is a little bit of acoustical, sort of what they call bioacoustical research. And not only the sound of water, but as I said, bird song. Apparently there are parts of our brain that evolved listening to these things. Mm-hmm. You know, for thousands of years, we've lived under the stars and under the skies. And so the perceptual parts of our brain that process stimuli are really used to processing things like water and birds and the sound of wind. You know, that's what our brain was sort of designed to process. It wasn't really designed to process, you know, honking horns or the pings coming up from our email or the sound of a subway system, you know, at 70 decibels or the sound of jet aircraft. And so when we hear some of those urban sounds, our stress responses really go up, especially if it's like a deep mechanical sound. Even if we're not aware of it, our stress response goes up. And there have been studies looking at people, for example, who sleep near an airport. And even though they're sleeping, parts of their body are sort of waking up when there's an aircraft taking off. So some of these things are very subtle and they're unconscious, but they actually do have health consequences over a lifetime. And you see people who live under these airports, they actually have more cardiovascular problems. They have higher incidence of stroke. They have some learning disabilities. All things like that.
Journalist Florence Williams is my guest. We're talking about her article in the January issue of National Geographic called This Is Your Brain on Nature. We'd love to hear from you about the ways that you use nature to unwind and whether it works for you. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also join the conversation by email to think@kera.org. And I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Florence Williams, whose article, This Is Your Brain on Nature, is in the January issue of National Geographic. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Florence, how is living near green space as good as getting a raise?
That came out of a study in Toronto where researchers were interested to know how people's health was affected by how many trees were on their block. And they compared people who lived on blocks with very few trees to people who lived on blocks with lots of trees. And what they found, this was really interesting, even if, you know, these people, you know, had the same kind of education levels, the same income levels, the people with more trees were so much healthier that it was equivalent to a $20,000 bump in income. Because, you know, we know people who have more money are healthier. So living with more trees was just like having a job that paid you $20,000 more.
I hate to ruin this whole thing by quantifying it, but is there like a recommended dose of nature every day?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the researchers in Finland and public health officials there are trying to answer that question. And what they've come up with, because, you know, Finland is kind of a dark country.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it has this long winter. People do get depressed there, and they also have job stress. You know, they're also spending too much time indoors like everybody else. But what they've come up with is that if people spend 5 hours a month walking in a forest, they can stave off depression. Wow. So I started to figure that out. 5 hours a month, you know, it's a little over an hour a week. So, you know, that's a couple of trips, you know, into a park of about 30 to 40 minutes each. And they're actually recommending that.
And in South Korea, they are, I guess building is the wrong word, but cultivating these places they call healing forests.
Yeah, that's really fascinating to me. The research there in Korea has led officials to, you know, sort of medicalize nature and to actually, you know, almost prescribe it. And so in order to ensure that the populace there get out and actually use the forests, they've designated certain sort of scenic areas as healing forests. And they're also training this whole legion of healing rangers whose job is really to help people feel better on these forests. And so they have classes for, pregnant women and sort of prenatal stress reduction. They have programs for cancer patients. There are programs for school children who have been affected by bullying. They send a train out from major urban centers. It's called the Happy Train. And they put kids on it, both who are victims of bullying and who are themselves the bulliers. And they find that after 2 or 3 days, you know, running around the woods, the kids actually just feel a lot better about themselves. Oh, and they also have programs, I think this is interesting, for kids with digital addiction, which is, you know, sort of a known, recognized condition in South Korea. Of course, we probably have that here, too, but we don't identify it as much.
I was stunned by the figure I read in your piece that American teenagers are spending, what, less than 10% spend time in nature every week?
Yeah, that was a statistic for teenagers, and it looks like only 10% of American teens are spending any time outside every day. So that's pretty shocking. And then for adults overall in the United States, we are only spending 5% of our day or less outside. So out of, you know, 24-hour cycle, we're spending less than an hour outside. And that's sort of shocking if you think about it. You know, we used to spend all of our time outside.
Yeah. And is that time, how much of the time is like from the parking lot to the grocery store and, you know, from the driveway
right,
to the
exactly.
house?
Exactly. Exactly. It's, you know, picking up your newspaper at the end of the drive. Yeah, it's amazing how disconnected we are from nature. And more so, you know, all the time. In fact, you know, if you're talking about national parks, this is the 100th anniversary of national parks. And, you know, the good news is that visitation numbers overall are up. Lots of people are going to parks. But on a per capita basis, each of us is spending less time in the parks, you know, than we were 5 or 10 years ago. And, of course, what's replaced that really is, you know, more time at work. But also more time inside where we're finding, you know, recreation on our devices. And that's true of adults. It's also true of kids.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Bob is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I was wanting to share an observation. Before I was a photographer, I was a banker, and I spent a lot of time in the office, you know, looking at a very short range. And at the end of the day, to relieve the stress, I would just look at the distance. And I wondered if just looking in the distance was a factor in this stress reduction of nature.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is, Bob. Thanks for your question. There have been a number of studies that they call window studies. And these are people who look out their windows. And depending on what they're looking at, they can, you know, enjoy some serious benefits. There was one hospital study that looked at patients recovering from gallbladder surgery. And half the patients had a view out their window of just another, you know, part of the building, bricks. And then the other half had views of trees and some lawn, some green space. And the ones with the window views, the good window views, asked for less pain medication. They had fewer behavioral problems, fewer complaints, and they were released from the hospital earlier.
And yet we don't often think to ask about the view if we have to be in the hospital.
That's right. That's right. These are really kind of subtle points that we don't necessarily think about. And when we're designing schools or when we're designing prisons or, you know, when we're designing housing projects, it really can affect the behavior and the outcomes of people in those environments if they have more pleasant environments.
Back to the phones now. We have Tom on the line in Las Colinas. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. We live in an area that's been impacted by the airport, DFW airport expansion, and we've lived there for 35 years. We have the benefit of trees in the about 7-8 months out of the year. We have oak trees that have got quite large. But my wife sleeps in the wintertime with headphones that are kind of like what the airport workers have on the flight line. Keep the noise down, because she can't sleep. So definitely the nature helps us, but it, you know, fortunately we don't have this live oaks.
That's a really interesting perspective. Thanks so much for your call, Tom. Anything there that you want to comment on, Florence?
Well, Tom, I will say I feel your pain because I also live very close to an airport in Washington, D.C., and, you know, it can be brutal. But I think you raise a good point, which is that the trees have a lot of value. They can have value in making our surroundings more comfortable. They have values in improving our health care. They have value in cleaning particulate pollution out of the air. And so the urban forest is an incredibly important and often undervalued resource. We don't often think that, you know, trees can provide benefits beyond just sort of looking pretty. But these studies are showing that actually the impacts can be pretty profound.
Is time outdoors spent working still relaxing? So if we're doing yard work or we're hunting or fishing, are we still relaxing?
I think it depends on your attitude, you know, like so many psychological things in life. Certainly a lot of people go hunting and fishing to relax, mm-hmm. and they gain tremendous benefits from that. It looks like gardeners, people who garden for fun and love doing that, also benefit. You know, there are a lot of programs all over this country for immigrants, for example, who can work on gardening projects where they can actually grow some vegetables from their home countries, where they can kind of bond with each other socially. These programs have been shown to have tremendous impact and a lot of benefits, especially for again, like warding off depression and sort of helping process, you know, pain in people's lives.
All right. Do we cancel out the beneficial effects if we, say, take our tablets outside and, you know, bring them along when we're wandering through nature?
You know, that's such a good question because it's being actively debated right now. There are a lot of people who are arguing that national parks should provide better cell phone service. And on places like the Appalachian Trail, a lot of young people are using the trail, which is great news, but they're bringing their music and their iPads and they're having dance parties, you know, with this really transportable technology. And so it's really a topic of controversy. But I will say that if you look at what the studies are showing us, you definitely seem to get less of a boost when you are looking at a phone or talking on a phone. So if you want this kind of full cognitive and relaxation benefits of being outside, it seems to be in your best interest to turn the phone off or put it in your back pocket and keep it there for as long as you can.
For emergency use only.
Emergency use only.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks. I just had a quote from Rachel Carson on a plaque I have in my wall. And I think it is beautiful. It's those who dwell among the beauties and mysteries of the earth are never alone or weary of life. And I just think that's beautiful.
Thanks for sharing that. Had you heard that before, Florence?
I have heard that. I'm a huge fan of Rachel Carson. I'm so glad that you read that quote. I think it's a beautiful quote also. And I feel like I really saw that quote in action. I spent a week on a river trip with women veterans suffering from PTSD, and the transformation in those women at the end of the week was so incredible. And I think it was partly that they felt great comfort in one another's company, but they also derived such great comfort from being in a living, active, beautiful environment.
We have a tweet here from a listener who wants to know if you're familiar with Richard Louv's work on nature deficit disorder and is curious about whether there's a difference in the way that adults respond to nature versus kids.
Good question. I'm a huge fan of Richard Louv's work. I think he's done a tremendous amount in raising awareness about especially the importance of getting children outside. And he's written a book about that. He's also written a book about getting adults outside. So I think he would think it's equally important for both. But what I will say about children is that children are really designed to explore. You know, that's what they do naturally. A toddler, you know, outside in a backyard is a happy toddler. You know, they're looking at the grass, they're looking at butterflies, they're running around. They're really using their senses and their brains and their bodies kind of the way that we were designed to do it. And so when instead we take these little tiny kids and we put them in preschools or in classrooms with four walls and we tell them they have to sit and learn how to use a pencil properly and draw their letters, you know, 2 years earlier than they used to, I really worry about those kids because they're not really getting the full spectrum of, you know, developmental exploration that they used to.
It is interesting because we go to great lengths to provide small children with colorful toys, right, and things that would basically approximate the effects of just wandering around outside in a relatively monitored environment and exploring.
Well, that's right. And if you think about stuffed animals, you know, we really recognize that there's this natural affinity between children and animals. I mean, children love animals. And yet, you know, we don't really provide much of a real environment for them to look at animals.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Len on the line in Fort Worth now. Hi, Len.
Yes, hi. I'm amazed at how right on this whole conversation is. I could lift out all kinds of comments made. I won't run off chasing any rabbits, but I thank you so much for having this on the air. And I want to say just a couple of things. One is a mentor of mine, I wanted to mention a book before I forget, Gerald May was a psychiatrist who moved into spiritual formation. And I was involved, I've been a chaplain, I was involved at the Shalane Institute for Spiritual Formation. And he wrote a wonderful book called The Wisdom of Wilderness, and kind of gets into that, with especially a focus on kind of connecting with our deepest sense of presence and calling and how we need nature in order to do that. And there's other resources that I found incredibly helpful, but it's wonderful hearing you all on the air. And one, and actually additional question is, this will be available on podcast, won't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Great. I'll tell lots of other folks. The other thing is, I just want to say from a personal experience, I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease when I was 13 and went to St. Jude Children's Hospital and back in 1970. And I sort of, it was such a shift in my life that I was kind of disconnected in ways. But I went through, you know, radiation, chemo, and surgery. But it wasn't until I went back to our home and I was sitting in the backyard and maybe a whole bunch of times, but in sitting in nature in the spring, feeling all of the being a part of something much bigger, that I really started to shift internally with what healing was about. And so I continue now in lots of different ways. I'm working with some people in Fort Worth in relation to that sort of thing, how with the Botanic Garden in various ways.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm glad you made it all these years after surviving childhood cancer. Florence, when I hear Lynn's comments, I think about the way that people, you know, for a long time would sort of send sick people out into nature. You know, they would go take a summer by the seaside, hoping that that time would somehow do something good for them.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's so interesting. The whole spa movement, certainly for many centuries, right? Wealthy people who had the resources would go to these spas to heal. And then, you know, the sort of medical industry really changed when we discovered, you know, penicillin and that so many diseases were caused by germs. We sort of went very far the other direction. And we put everyone in a climate controlled, you know, fully walled in environment and just gave them pills. And it looks like now, you know, there's this realization that, well, maybe there was some original wisdom, you know, in the environment and in the environment's capacity to heal us. And what I'm seeing is that there's a little bit of a more, you know, sort of a recognition that a holistic approach might be helpful in some chronic diseases and also in quite a lot of mental illness. It was interesting that your caller, you know, brought up hospitals because even Walter Reed now, you know, medical hospital in Maryland near where I live, has put in a mile-long landscaped garden that follows a creek and a path. And there's really this, you know, kind of amazing recognition, even on in the part of the military, that what we're doing hasn't really worked in terms of just medication or just psychotherapy, but that we need to actually look at the environment. And it's been fun to watch that.
Does novelty matter, Florence? When we talk about brain benefits, so often we like to give our brains new things to think about, to process. Does the same stretch of trail do as much for us as something brand new?
Wow, that's a sort of philosophical question, isn't it? Because I think it was Socrates who said, there's no such thing as the same river twice. You know, that even in nature, everything is always changing. So there are always new birds coming in. There are always new buds coming up. And I think that's one of the things that nature provides is this kind of, you know, constant, you know, changing landscape of, you know, dynamic qualities.
Journalist Florence Williams is my guest. We're talking about her article, This Is Your Brain on Nature, which appears in the January issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to share a story or ask a question, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour to Florence Williams, who wrote an article called This Is Your Brain on Nature for the current issue of National Geographic. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Brian in Dallas. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. There's a lot of people that are stuck in spaces that don't have any good light, such as an office. And I know a lot of hotel chains and cruise lines have started to put in kind of, call it fake scenery, like on a plasma screen or something like that, that simulates nature. And I was just wondering kind of what the data shows on these kind of fake nature images and the impact on people.
Thanks for your call.
I'm familiar with some of that research, and There really are some effects, it looks like, sometimes, especially in, for example, a hospital waiting room, or even sometimes you'll see beautiful mountains on the ceiling of your dentist's office because, you know, you spend so much time looking up. And what the studies have shown is that there can be some reduction in stress response. So if you're having your teeth drilled, you might be somewhat slightly comforted by looking at a picture of a mountain. So we are seeing some of that.
Well, we have a tweet here that it just says curiosity/nature relationship. So I'm gonna take that to mean are people who like to spend time in nature more apt to be curious than the average person?
I haven't seen any specific studies about that. There is a researcher in Canada who is looking at whether we may behave in ways that are kind of more communitarian when we spend time in nature. Not only do we care about the environment and care about conservation, for example, care about climate change when we spend more time in nature, but we also seem to behave more generously toward one another, which I think is really interesting.
Hmm. And people feel better about themselves when they've spent time in nature, like less self-critical.
That's right. There was an interesting study out of Stanford recently in which a researcher asked people to go for a 90-minute walk either on a busy city street in Palo Alto or in kind of a nature park area. And then he actually looked inside their brains using, I think it was MRI. And what he found was that the people who walked in the natural areas had less activation in the parts of their brain that ruminate. So, you know, when you're sometimes, you know, when you're obsessed with maybe negative thoughts about yourself, in psychology, that's known as rumination. You're just like working over these things you've done wrong in your life over and over and over again. And there's one particular part of the brain that is very involved in that. And when we go out in nature, that part of the brain kind of dials down.
It seems like that alone would be incentive enough to get out there. Why, you know, Florence, we all have experienced that where it feels great to be outside and you'll say, this is so nice. What keeps us from engaging in nature if we know it feels good?
So it looks as though we don't really recognize it enough. We know it feels good, but we just don't think it's that important. When we want to feel better, we do things like turn on the television or we go shopping. We think those things will make us feel better. But actually, those things often make us feel worse, it turns out. And so part of it is that we just haven't really recognized the power of the parks and the power of nature to really improve both our, our emotional selves and also our creative and cognitive selves.
I've wondered, too, if the idea that so much gear exists now for really serious outdoors people, it's almost a disincentive to just casually go out there and take a little stroll where you don't need, a backpack and a space blanket and all that.
That's one thing that really cracked me up about Korea is that they're really into the gear there. So you see people going into the parks and they've got their pocket knives and they've got their, special shoes and their special gaiters and their special jackets. It does seem, that could be kind of intimidating to some people. But certainly if you go in my neighborhood, you'll just see people practically out in their pajamas, walking their dogs and going out into nature. You really don't need much.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Julie on the line in Bedford. Hey, Julie.
Hi. I read a novel a couple years ago that mentioned the phrase eternal calm, and it has come back to me a couple times, once when I was up in the North Woods in Wisconsin last summer, and recently walking a boardwalk in the Gulf, on Gulf Shores, Alabama, and I thought the phrase was so appropriate because what I have found I felt in those instances was a sense of eternal calm, and I just thought I'd like to share that.
Thanks so much for your call.
Oh, I love that. That's really a beautiful phrase. And I think, that's what we're seeing in some of these brain studies, is that we're seeing brain states that are really calm compared to kind of our usual, working, crazy, multitasking selves.
So are these studies, of course, you have to be really careful not to bias the results based on what people expect. Can you talk a little bit about how they're set up to minimize the chances that people think, well, this is probably a study where I'm being tested to see how calm I feel? Is that easy to do to eliminate that bias?
Yeah, I was curious about that, too, because, when you take a mood test, for example, in nature versus the city, you may be kind of on to the hypothesis a little bit. And so I asked that question, too, of a number of researchers. And what they're trying to do is really devise, these sort of tests that you can't really game. For example, an EEG, which is measuring your brain waves, you can't necessarily really tell your brain to behave a certain way. I mean, maybe you can, but I certainly haven't figured out how to do that. Your cortisol levels, that's a stress hormone. That's a pretty objective measure of your stress response and what's going on.
Does this work in all weather, or do the conditions have to be really idyllic for us to enjoy nature?
That's a good question, because certainly sometimes, especially this time of year, on places like the East Coast and the Great Plains, you may not be so motivated to get outside and calm down. But there was a study in Michigan, and this researcher had people go walk in a park when it was pouring rain and cold. And even then, so interesting, even then he found these benefits in their creativity and their short-term memory and also in their mood. So they may have been grumbling the whole time about how cold and miserable they were. But, after the walk, they really showed in their brains and in their moods these benefits.
Let's talk next on the phone to Steve in Euless. Hello, Steve.
Hey, how are you? It's been a long time. Happy New Year to you. I want to share one of my favorite quotes by John Muir. In wilderness is the preservation of the world. I grew up on the Pacific Coast Trail and in Sierra Nevada and went backpacking solo at the age of 15. I have never felt so small, and I've never felt so powerful. Taking care of oneself and also experience the grandeur, it is a religious experience. And you can tell I'm speaking from the heart, dear.
Thank you so much for your call, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. John Muir was such an important figure in the creation of the National Park Service. and the national park system in the U.S. He really advocated for protecting Yosemite, and he really understood and recognized that these places needed to be protected not just because they were beautiful and they had, you know, nice scenery and they had nice wild animals, but also because they actually protected humanity, that we needed these wild spaces in order to go back to civilization and act like civilized human beings.
We have an email here from Dorothy who writes, my husband has discovered he can hitch his canoe to his bike and pedal it from our house to the Trinity River offshoots or creeks. He then takes the wheels off the bike, loads it into the canoe, and paddles it out to his takeout point, puts it back together and drives and rides home. They also have a tandem bike that'll do this. And his observations are he rarely runs into anyone else on the river, and especially not bike canoeists. And he says being in nature feeds all his senses, plus he gets a good workout.
Well, I would like that life. can you show me how to do that? That sounds great. That sounds creative. I think, you know, one of the things about nature is that it's not really a ready-made experience. You know, there isn't necessarily, you know, a kiosk or a guidebook or a map or a computer program that tells us exactly how to do it. And that's part of the fun. You know, we have to explore it and figure it out for ourselves.
What do you think? Some people are frightened to be out in nature, like people who have grown up in cities and who are most comfortable in urban environments. It seems somehow foreign and scary to be in places where humans are not in control of every single thing.
Well, nature can be scary. You know, I don't want to over-romanticize it. There are hazards in nature. there are predators. You know, there's Lyme disease. There's poison ivy. I've had poison ivy. I've had Lyme disease. So, these things are out there. And it's certainly true that not everyone is comfortable in nature. In the studies that I've seen and the researchers I've talked to, a lot of them have said that there seems to be a population that's kind of immune to the benefits of nature. Maybe like 10 to 15% of people just will not really calm down or feel happy after being in nature. And that's because, you know, maybe they're particularly anxious about bugs or about rain or about weather. And what that says to me, you know, it's sort of heartbreaking. It says to me that as children, you know, these individuals never really got an opportunity to spend time in nature and to feel comfortable there. And so what it says to me is that we kind of have a responsibility, I think, as, you know, as parents, as educators, as a society, to really make an effort to get our children out into nature and to help them feel comfortable there. Because once they do that, they will have a resource that they can draw on for the rest of their lives.
I didn't expect to read that people who live near parks but never go there are still better off than people who don't.
That's right. That came out of a study in the UK, and it was a very large study looking at tens of thousands of people and where they lived, how close to green space they lived, and what kinds of diseases they suffered from, and also even their death rates. And what it showed was that people who lived closer to nature had a lower death rate, even if they never used the nature. So even if they never spent time in the parks or never walked in the parks, they still benefited just from this very kind of subtle stress reduction influence.
So you write a lot about outdoor adventure. You talk to a lot of people who have made this into a lifestyle. If you had to identify what's different about people who just sort of intrinsically understand the benefits of nature, what do you think it is?
Well, I think it probably does come back to culture, you know, and to family culture and how they were raised as children. So I think the people who seem to benefit the most from nature and enjoy it the most, you know, just had more exposure to it early on and, you know, really learned to appreciate it.
Should we think about the amount of nature when we're making housing decisions?
Absolutely. You know, people who are wealthy have always, throughout time, have always benefited from beautiful places. You know, the wealthy had their second homes, or they had their estates, or they had their homes by the lake. But the fact is, most of us don't have those kinds of resources. And most people who live in cities don't have them. And as, you know, as our world goes on, more and more of us will be living in cities. I think something like 70% of the global population will be living in these mega cities. And cities in general, you know, within the next 20 years. And so it becomes really important to think about how to plan for them to be, you know, their best kind of psychological and cognitive selves. We have to make sure that that you know, they're healthy and happy, and I think what people are understanding now is that nature is not just a luxury, but it's actually a necessity.
Let's very quickly go to a final call from Taiba in Frisco. Hi.
Hello, Chris. I just wanted to thank you for a beautiful topic. And I would like to share a little experience in my life about that. When I was little, my mom would always tell me before I used to sleep, she would tell me to imagine yourself in something that will make you really happy. And that was always about nature. Like if I'm standing in a beautiful forest and it's raining, and I would also think myself in a desert, and that would really feel me happy and make me sleep really good. So that's what I wanted to share.
Wonderful advice. Thank you so much for your call. And it sounds like wise words, Florence Williams.
That's just a beautiful thought. I love ending on that. And I will just say, if your listeners are interested, you know, National Geographic is also airing a TV special on this topic, The Power of Parks, and that's airing on Sunday evening.
Oh, fantastic. We can definitely look out for that. Journalist Florence Williams is the author of an article entitled This Is Your Brain on Nature. It appears in the January issue of National Geographic magazine, and the corresponding special, I guess, happens Sunday evening. Florence, what a pleasure this was. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much, Chris. I enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, and Jeff Weddington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.